on air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Throughout the inquiry, I note that the suppliers, the few that have identified themselves, have not been direct suppliers to Coles.
And the communities on the west coast that have just faded away.
Did you see those two iron bars sticking up there? That's where the bakery used to be.
Right.
And as far as I know to this day, the oven is still in amongst all that rubble.
We'll also talk to Australia's captain of the national wood chopping team, Amanda Beams, and what makes a top woodcutter. And we're going to look at abattoirs again. Lots to talk about today. So please have your say on the text line 0438 922 936. But first, supermarket giant Coles says it feels the challenges of the horticulture sector and is happy to sit down with growers to discuss that. Leaders from Coles fronted the Senate inquiry into supermarket prices yesterday afternoon. Here are senior managers at Coles CEO Leah Workett and Government and Industry Relations Manager Vicky Bonn under questioning from New South Wales National Senator Ross Cadell, who started out by asking what proportion of supplier cost price increases the supermarket approved.
The vast majority of cost price increases during those years were either fully or partially granted.
No actual. Can we get numbers on notice?
I don't have access to them today, but we're again happy to take that on notice.
Thank you very much.
This comment that we pay market price, we're not paying market price at the market, we're paying market price by direct negotiation, aren't we, for fresh fruit and veg?
In the first instance, our supplier will say this is the price that we would like. We then would have a look at the market price and we agree a price through negotiation after that. And I think it's worth noting, Senator, I think there's an assumption that often the price is less than the grower will ask for. It's actually sometimes more as well.
How often would that happen?
I would have to take that on notice, but I know it does happen because I've actually sat with our buyers as they've been negotiating, so I've actually seen
it. I won $500 on Lotto once, but it's not often. Suppliers to Woolworths before this evidence have said every time they have to go on promo, the supplier is required to fund 100% of that promo. In a question on notice, your answer is some price decreases are solely funded by Coles, some are solely funded by the supplier, and some are funded by both Coles and supplier. Would you have a rough breakdown of how many fit into each of those three categories?
So a example of where Coles would be the sole funder of a promotion would be on a Coles brand product or an exclusive proprietary product, for example, that we have in our store, which quite often we'll make commitments to the supplier around volume, and so we will fund promotions to ensure that we're delivering against that. An example where a supplier would be the sole funder would be what I would describe as a shelf-only promotion. So that would be a promotion that doesn't go on to an end. At the end of the aisle, you would all be aware that's where you find the biggest promotions that are on sale that week in our store. So when I talk a shelf-only promotion, that would be a product that is not going to go on an end. It would probably have a more modest reduction, let's say a 10 or a 15% reduction. And commonly you would find that our big specials that you find in the catalogues, which would be like a 40 or 50% off, they would be the ones where it would be most common to find that they are co-funded by both the retailer, by Coles and the supplier. You know, part of the reason for that is they are the ones that drive the big volume, and so it's about sharing risk appropriately between the two parties. And not putting that risk, you know, just in one place.
Would you be opposed to the Hort Code replacing the grocery code for people supplying directly to you?
I don't think we have a particular view on it, but I think philosophically what we recognise is that there are challenges in the horticultural space at the moment, and there are growers that feel that they don't have sufficient transparency And we're certainly happy to be engaged in conversations which would improve that.
We saw witnesses shaking giving evidence to us in Orange and Tasmania. As much as, you know, there are other channels to market, you're the lifeblood. If you control the channel to market, you control the business. When they're too scared to talk to us under protection, when they're too scared to raise it under sitting down with us, what can we do to give these people greater confidence that if they raise legitimate concerns, there won't be the fear of penalty, there won't be the fear of retribution, there won't be fear of their entire business and life going up in smoke because you didn't like what they said?
It's incumbent on us to consistently show through our behaviours that things are changing. And certainly that has been the intent around changing some of our processes. One of our core values at Coles is that we care for each other. And we talk about that in relation to our team, but we also talk about that in relation to our suppliers. It concerns me greatly that there are suppliers that worry about fear of retribution, which is why we have put in processes where senior leaders are more involved when issues and disputes are raised. But I think it is going to take years and multiple rounds of retailers showing that they do the right thing to fully rectify the problem.
And that was Liberal Senator Maria Kovacic, who also asked Coles about the allegations suppliers have been bullied and intimidated by supermarkets. And Coles Chief Executive Leah Workart responds.
What is the basis of these allegations? If you aren't seeing it, but we're getting so many people coming forward and saying this is what's happening, obviously something isn't right somewhere.
In relation to the allegations that have been made throughout the inquiry, I note that the suppliers, the few that have identified themselves, have not been direct suppliers to Coles. So if there are any suppliers that any of you know of or that have come to you that claim that Coles has not treated them fairly, we would invite those suppliers and yourselves to meet with us so you're in the room. And we can talk through any issue, because that is not consistent with the way we do business.
That's absolutely huge. Good on you. Okay.
Thank you, because the challenge is that people are afraid to speak, but that I agree with Senator Stirl. That is, an important offer. Thank you.
Now, the New South Wales Farmers Horticulture Committee member Johanna Briganti-Barnard told Hugh Hogan the stats are really clear about who's making money and who's not. The figures have shocked farmers like Johanna Briganti-Barnard, who sits on the New South Wales Farmers Horticultural Committee. She tells Hugh Hogan the stats show who's making money.
I mean, that's pretty horrendous numbers when you look against the rest of the world. I think like Walmart in the US, major company, 18%. I think some in the UK, around 12%. So you can see these guys are making record profits. And this is what it comes down to, making record profits, yet the consumers are hurting and so are the suppliers. You know, there is no fairness at the moment because of the level of market concentration and power these two have. And I think what was really telling with, if I say Woolworths, you could see how the refusal to answer. That's the example of the culture that we deal with as suppliers. And when you look at Coles, it's a complete denial that there's a problem in the system, and very much that it's all wonderful and they're looking after everybody. And it's not the case, because farmers are going out the door backwards and consumers are barely being able to afford groceries that they could afford a year ago.
And in terms of the market concentration, that was one of the big talking points as well, with both of the Coles and Woolworths saying that it is a competitive market. What are your thoughts on that stance, that the supermarket industry is a competitive one, and what impact does that have on producers?
Yeah, look, it absolutely isn't. They're nearly 70% of the retail sales in Australia. So anybody of... And it's funny, you know, they often said, oh, you know, it's a small supplier that struggles. It's not the small supplier. It's just as much the large suppliers. In fact, if they couldn't sell the volume of product that they now produce for these two and they had to put it on the central market, you wouldn't... What the term is, if you would previously do that, you would flood the central market, you know. that would be like a tsunami if one of these larger suppliers put that volume of product onto the central markets. So they have, and they would just lose money hand over fist. You know, if suppliers are saying they're barely meeting the cost of production and they're leaving the industry, that clearly means they're not getting enough, they're not getting their cost plus a return on their investment. When consumers are saying, you know, that the price increases are so significant they can't afford, you know, to buy some basics anymore, yet the middleman is making billion-dollar record profits and return on equity, those numbers we're seeing, then it's just so obvious that two people are getting gouged in this system, and that's the consumer and the farmer or the suppliers. Something needs to be done about that culture.
And that was New South Wales Farmers Horticulture Committee member Johanna Briganti-Barnard speaking there. Now, the Australian women's team wood chopping captain is Amanda Beams. That announcement was made recently at the Royal Easter Show in Sydney. And I've got Amanda on the line now. Good afternoon, Amanda.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're, as part of being captain of the team and part of the Australian team in wood chopping, you're going to compete against New Zealand, is that correct?
That's correct, at the upcoming Royal Adelaide Show, the 31st of August, Adelaide Show starts.
Okay, so it's a pretty big deal. You're, you know, top of your field in the nation. How did you sort of get into this team? What's led to this, you being picked in the national team?
To get picked in a national team, it's no different to any other sport. I guess you've got to have the runs on the board, and in this case it's the blocks cut and the wheels sawed and consistent performances and I guess good performances overall.
And you recently competed in Sydney at the Royal Sydney Show. How did you go there?
Oh, I didn't have as successful Sydney show as I would have liked, but I competed. I made the final of both world titles, so that was an achievement in itself. But, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't do as well as I thought I could have done.
No doubt you're pretty tough on yourself. Tell me, what were those events that you made the finals in?
For the very first time at Sydney Show, two world titles were conducted for women. One was the 325 millimetre single-handed sawing world title, and the other was a 275 underhand. So, yeah.
When you're talking about a 325, what are you talking about there, diameter of the log or?
Exactly.
Right, so that's pretty big.
Yeah, 325 is only a 13.
Only a 13, whatever that means.
Only a 13-inch.
Yep. So
when you think that the boys, like when the boys saw the world title double-handed sawing, that's 600, that's 24-inch. So,
right.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a bit of size difference.
Almost double, but obviously someone got that world title?
Yeah, Janiah Shadlow from New South Wales won the single. She did.
And is she in the Australian team as well?
Yeah, she actually gets her debut in the Australian women's team from pretty much herself and Chris Brown, Jill and Jill, saw together, and they've had really good performances over the last couple of years. So along with her single performance, yeah, she's got herself into the Australian team.
And what would you say is your sort of signature events in terms of what cutting events do you like the most?
The underhand's my pet event. And, I always cut the first underhand in the women's teams race.
What does that mean? Can you explain to people who don't know much about wood chopping, what is the underhand cutting?
Underhands, when you're standing on the log and you're cutting between your feet, and a lot of people go,
yes,
but it's not that bad. Like, we've got protection on our feet where we wear chainmail on our feet, so if it does actually slip, you're not going to hurt yourself, and it's actually the safest way to start wood chopping is with the underhand. But in the teams race format, we cut underhand, Jill and Jill, Jill single, Jill and Jill, and then finish with an underhand. So there's three disciplines. Two are repeated, but the singles only cut once in the actual format of the race.
Okay, and the Jill and Jill, that's two women on either end of the saw?
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, and that's a pretty tough competition as well.
Yeah, well, that's what Janaya and Chris Brown, both very good sawyers, and, yeah, pretty good pair they are together.
Okay, now how do you go about practising? You live, I believe you still live up in Beaconsfield Way. You've got a family of wood choppers. So what do you all do to keep your skills up?
Yeah, we live in Winkley, actually, not quite as far as Beaconsfield. We're out on the farm, so we've got plenty of area to do our training. I've got a personal trainer, Nick Shearer. He's training us pretty hard. And as well as that, I've got a physio. I've recently had some shoulder surgery, so I've had to engage a physio just to get full movement back in my shoulder. And, yeah, a lot of it's training a couple of nights a week with Nick, physio once every couple of weeks, and then, yeah, whatever wood chopping and sawing I can do at home on the farm in the spare time.
And you said you had the personal trainer, Nick Shearer. So is he taking you through fitness, or is he also helping you with chopping?
Yeah, Nick's very, very good at what he does. And, yeah, to start with, we concentrate on our cardio and getting fit, and then comes the weights and the actual targeting the areas of our body that we need for wood chopping and sawing.
And is that just arms, or is it core as well?
No, it's basically all over. You've got to have everything. You need everything. You start with your core and then your legs and then your arms. So, yeah, you've got to build it all up.
Yeah, so you'd be pretty fit by the sounds of it.
Yeah, for a 53-year-old, I don't go too bad.
And look, just finally, your husband has been inducted into the Australian Axeman's Hall of Fame for 2024 as well. So another great thing for your family.
Yeah, absolutely. Dale's been a tireless worker all his life for wood chopping and as a competitor, and a lot of administration along the way. And it's just a little bit of a reward for, yeah, everything that he's put in.
And a good support for you in your quest in the national team.
Yeah, he's not as competitive as he was in wood chopping now, so... Yeah, he's more or less my caddy and a pretty hard trainer as well. So, yeah, and we've got the boys coming through. So, yeah, he's very, very good too.
Fantastic. Okay, Amanda Beams, captain of the Australian Women's Woodchopping Team, thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
You're welcome. Thanks, Fiona.
Writing a will can actually be a joyous occasion. It's not about you dying necessarily. It's about you giving things to people. Imagine being able to give your loved ones a house, a car, or even just that little knick-knack they loved. I'm Mel Bush. Get started on your will this weekend when will expert Bridget Reinberger joins us to answer your questions about planning your estate. Will's Talkback from 10 a.m. this Saturday from ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, towns on Tasmania's west coast have ridden the boom and bust of the forestry, hydroelectric and mining industries. Some have lived and some have died. But are there lessons to be learnt? Meg Powell went traipsing about some ghost towns to find out.
Keep going. This pianola once sat in a hotel that no longer exists. It's a relic of a town that died last century. Gormanston was a mining town buried in the mountains of Tasmania's wild west coast. It was once home to 2,000 people, a courthouse, a jail, a school, and 8 pubs. But the town's population began to dwindle in the 1920s after the nearby Iron Blow mine was phased out.
Oh, I come up every now and again and have a wander around and just remember where things used to be and what it used to be like.
Ralph Burns is one of the oldest original residents.
I'm originally from Gormanston, 27 years here before I got married and I had to move down to Queenstown. Well, this area here, just here, was the Federation Hotel there. And you see those 2 iron bars sticking up there? That's where the bakery used to be.
Right.
And as far as I know to this day, the oven is still in amongst all that rubble. I thought it was very good, you know. We had plenty to do. We made our own fun. Walked around all these hills. You know. And we had a great time growing up. Used to sledge down these hills, you know, and get a sheet of iron and bend the front of it up and hang on to it and sledge down the hills. Yeah, hit the bottom of the hill and have skin offers and everything like that. No, we'd go up again and do the same thing again. It's a bit sad in a way, but it's a shame it's been let go the way it's been let go. But hopefully down the track, maybe not in my time, the government might start building houses up here. You know, because they're going to need places to build houses eventually. Because of the population growth. Yeah.
Gormanston is not the only ghost town in the area whose fate has rested on the success of a single industry.
Oh, a lot of them are not very big.
Historian Michael Holmes says nearly 70 towns have disappeared from Tasmania's west coast since European settlement.
And the construction of railways. The primary reason is that they run out of resource, particularly in mining, and the second one is changes in technology, like cars replaced horses or footwork. The telephone and internet has changed dramatically the circumstances, and they finished building the railway or they finished building the dam.
Saul Eslek, independent economist, Vice-Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Tasmania. Well, at the time of Federation, in the 1890s and in the 1910s, mining was one of the most important activities in Tasmania, and although we don't have accurate figures, it probably accounted for well over 10% of Tasmania's economy. As recently as the mid-1970s, mining appeared to account for about 8% of Tasmania's economy, and most of that, of course, was concentrated on the west coast. Today, however, mining accounts for barely 4% of Tasmania's economy. It's still the mainstay of the west coast, of course, but it's not as big on the west coast as it used to be, and there's less mining activity in other parts of Tasmania, such as the Fingal Valley or around Methina or at Beaconsfield, as there used to be. Well, it's always risky to have your economic eggs in one basket, and that applies to nations as much as it does to states or individual towns and cities. Other parts of Australia are littered with towns that sprung up in order to exploit a mineral resource, and when that mineral resource was fully exploited and run down and there was nothing else for people in the town to do, the town died. You can see ghost towns across Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. And of course, we've got them too. There are also towns, for example, in the northwest coast of Tasmania out the back of Smithton, that used to depend on a particular agricultural industry or on forestry that are no longer there anymore because that industry either died or moved away.
While Gormanston died at the whim of big business, something different killed Burn Bradford's village. The thriving sawmill town of Princess River was built around the production of rare Tasmanian timbers, Huon pine, myrtle, sassafras and King Billy.
I live in Queenstown these days. And, you know, I'm near the end of my life on earth. I can still talk and eat and all those sorts of things. And
how old are you?
Argue the point. Oh, I'll be 94 next month, yeah. Well, the time the flooding was due, Dad had passed away, and the chap from the land department rang me this day and said, Mr. Bradshaw, we have to inform you that you have to leave. And I said, I can't afford to leave. They said, you have to leave. It's going to be flooded.
By the early 1990s, the small village was under what became Lake Burbury, drowned to make way for a new venture, hydroelectricity.
So, you know, the houses and the mill and everything like that was had to be abandoned. They pulled most of the houses down and, you know, there was 80-odd truckloads of stuff come into here from Princess when we moved.
Of the many industry towns that have lived and died, at least two of them, Strawn and Queenstown, reinvented themselves as tourist destinations.
The fact that towns rise and fall, that are born and then die because their existence has depended on a single commodity or a single mine, is something that's been characteristic of human history down the ages. I think the lesson is that towns and communities need to try, if they can, to have more than one string to their bow.
And that was the pianola that once stood in a pub in the ghost town of Gormanston, finishing up that report by Meg Powell. Time for the news headlines now with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Fiona. Westfield owner Centre Group has announced the Bondi Junction shopping centre in Sydney's east will reopen tomorrow for a community reflection day. There'll be no retail trade and members of the community will be able to visit the centre to pay their respects to those killed in a knife attack on Saturday. Counselling services will be on site. Australia's projected defence spending will increase by another $50 billion over the next decade, with the government unveiling an immediate boost of more than $1 billion to accelerate long-range missiles and targeting systems, as well as lethal autonomous systems. Defence Minister Richard Marles has released Labor's long-awaited National Defence Strategy, which aims to put Australia's total defence spending at 2.4% of GDP within 10 years. The backing of strict smoking bans in the UK has reignited old debates in Tasmania. Today, MPs in the UK backed a ban on smoking for those born after 2009. Almost a decade ago, then independent MLC Ivan Dean drafted a bill that would have banned the sale of cigarettes in Tasmania to anyone born after the year 2000. And Federal Opposition Leader Peter Dutton says he's continuing to scout locations in WA for proposed nuclear power reactor sites. These include the southwest town of Collie, which will have its coal-fired power station phased out by 2030. For Bulletin at 1.
Thank you, Ellie. Time to cross to the Weather Bureau now. And good afternoon, Michael Conway.
Hi, Fiona.
Has there been much rainfall overnight?
Not today since 9 o'clock, but yesterday, actually this morning, there was. Eddiston Point was the top at around 11 millimetres isolated fall there, and there wasn't really anything else much around the state other than Zeehan in the west, which had 2 millimetres.
Okay, now tell me about the outlook.
Yeah, so tomorrow we're getting a cold front coming over. It'll develop during the day and move over the state and then quickly move away. It's not a particularly strong or windy front, but it will bring showers, especially into the west, and looking like 5 to 15 millimetres there in the west. The rest of the state may get showers, some light showers, so up to, you know, 1 or 2 millimetres, but you may miss out as well. But it's a bit hit and miss, but that'll move through during the day tomorrow and then pretty quickly move off, and then we'll get a pretty settled day on Friday with a ridge moving over. After that, though, the westerlies will continue into the weekend, although they'll be quite light. It'll be lovely and warm for most of the state with maximum temperatures around the 20 marks. And so lovely weather after the cold front coming through tomorrow.
Ooh, that does sound good. Any warnings?
We got a strong warning for southern waters, so southeast and southwest waters today. The southern waters, southeast and southwest, turn into gales tomorrow. Gale wind warning for westerly winds, and we've got a strong wind warning for all other coastal waters as that cold front moves through.
Okay, coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, okay. So today the winds are south to southwesterly at 10 to 20 knots in the northwest, variable 5 to 15 knots elsewhere, although increasing to be west to northwesterly 20 to 30 knots in the south in the evening. Tomorrow the winds will be west to northwesterly at 15 to 25 knots, reaching up to 25 to 35 knots about the south, and only 10 to 15 knots in the upper east. Winds tend west to southwesterly 15 to 25 knots throughout in the afternoon, and then 10 south to southwesterly in the evening. The swell's about in the west and south for both days. There's a southwest at 3 to 4 metres, in the north, westerly to 1 metre for both days, and in the east for both days again, southerly at 1 to 2 metres, reaching a southwesterly up to 3.5 metres offshore in the south for both days.
All right, Michael Conway, thanks very much.
Cheers, Fiona. Have a good day.
Nightlife with Phil Clark.
We're about to play the Mighty Challenge. We're up to question 12, but more importantly, 10 in a row for the Black Magnets. Yeah. Which future US president married school librarian Laura Welsh in 1977?
George W. Bush.
10 in a row.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. I'm going
to die happy. Nightlife, Monday to Thursday with Philip Clark on ABC Radio Hobart. Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, we've heard a lot about abattoirs in Tasmania lately. Hidden cameras exposing mistreatment of animals, temporary suspension of export licences, and then changes to abattoirs in Tasmania. A task force was set up to look into those things. And yesterday, the Greens called for the reports from that task force to be released. Dr. Rosalie Woodruff called on the government to update the public on what action had been taken in the wake of the release of that CCT footage by animal campaigners. She says it's been 6 months now since the revelations. We followed up with new Primary Industries Minister Jane Howlett, who released a statement saying all abattoirs were notified in March that mandatory video surveillance must be operating within 3 months, and the task force distributed guidelines to all Tasmanian abattoirs and knackeries. The task force is also developing guidelines for livestock processing facilities, including facility design, pre-slaughter care and handling, and emergency killing. Two new animal welfare officers were appointed in December, and the government says a 2030 strong plan for Tasmania's future includes an additional $1.2 million for Biosecurity Tasmania over 3 years for animal welfare. Now, apart from that bigger issue, we've also heard from farmers in the south of Tasmania who have had nowhere to send their livestock now that their local abattoir is up for sale. It's certainly a fraught sector. I've got Jen Robertson from Sprout, a mentoring farmer group who's been awarded a grant from the state government to review the state of play in this sector. Jen joins me in the studio today. Good afternoon.
Hi, Fiona.
Thank you for coming in. Now, you're on that task force, aren't you, that's looking into abattoirs?
Yes, I am.
So what can you tell us from that?
Oh, look, obviously, you know, the minister's made the statement and I'm not actually able to share any of the details from the task force discussion, but I can share that I'm absolutely thrilled to be a part of what is a very collegiate, wonderful, collaborative group of people that are all coming together to do their very best to bring about the outcomes that we're all focused on, which is the very best of animal welfare, so that our farmers feel comfortable and consumers as well can feel comfortable that this is the process that is happening across the state. So a lot of work is being done. We meet fortnightly. You know, we're all giving our all to this process. There is no silver bullet, but we're absolutely doing our very best.
And all sorts of people on that?
Yes, absolutely. Representation across lots of different parts of the sector.
And, of course, your experience is in small producers and you've worked with quite a few that are actually having a bit of trouble at the moment because they haven't got their local abattoir anymore. This is just one of the many problems in the sector, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I think this is not a new issue. I think even right across Australia and globally, actually, the consolidation of abattoir processing facilities has brought about many challenges. Obviously, there have been some benefits as well, but from the perspective of the farmers that we work with, it's meant that we've uncovered through our surveys and conversations with them that a lot of them have challenges in this space. They can't find an abattoir that can actually process their animals in a way that fits with their values and what they need for their business. So in terms of animal welfare and high quality product. And they like to sell their product direct to their consumer. They want to be in control of their product. It's a problem that we've identified over, you know, many years, really. So it's really wonderful to finally have this funding to do some of this research.
So this funding, you actually put the proposal to government that you wanted to do a review. What sorts of things did you propose you'd look at?
Yes, so we applied for this grant and have done over many years, so it's great to see that it's finally got across the line. So we're essentially doing a scan of the state of everything to do with what we call service kill processing, which is essentially an abattoir providing a service for a farmer where they can take their animal in and get everything that they would like back, everything from hide and, you know, hoofs and everything cuts back to them, and then they get that processed in a way that they do. For some of them, it's processing on their own farm if they have a butchery on site. For others, it's coordinating and collaborating with other services in their local community to get that process done for them and then selling their product direct to their customers. So we're looking at that part of it, but the whole chain essentially. So where can people get their animals processed? What are the logistics that are there in terms of pre and post that processing? What butchering is there out there? What training is currently sort of being undertaken? What thirst is there for people to actually learn this kind of skill in butchery? Because it is, anecdotally, a sort of a dying skill in the butchery space. What cool room and other infrastructure do people have access to? How many meat inspectors do we have, and what does that actually look like in terms of how can you get trained if you need a new meat inspector? And so looking at that education piece as well, and then obviously thinking about environmental and biosecurity consideration. So it's a bit a little bit overwhelming to think about all of those pieces.
It sounds like a huge, remit, so to speak.
Yeah, it is, but I think for me, the way that Sprout and me personally look at things is very much with a broad lens. You can't silo this into one channel. This is a part of a food system, and so we need to look at it holistically, essentially.
I know that in Victoria, for example, there's long been a campaign by small producers to be allowed to butcher on their own properties, because there's all sorts of legislation governing that, and I believe they did actually win that right. Eventually, we've interviewed one of the women that was key to that. Could we see more bespoke sort of stuff like that happening here in Tassie?
Yeah, so part of this project is going to be looking at models like that. You're referencing Tammy Jonas from Jonai Farms in Victoria. So there's some wonderful models out there. There's also cooperative models in the Murray Plains co-op abattoir. There's also mobile abattoirs in Provenir, which is operating in New South Wales and Victoria, I believe, potentially even Queensland.
We've got
don't
one,
quote me on that.
At least one here in Tasmania. Mobile abattoir or mobile butcher maybe?
So here in Tasmania currently, mobile abattoir is allowed but only for personal use. So
right.
Anybody that utilises that service on their property, that meat can't be sold.
It's not for commercial.
No. Yeah. And so that's obviously our gold standard for a lot of our farmers would be enabling their animals to not leave their farm. It's less stress, it's less cost. It really enables them to be in control of this process. And it would be great if we can look at, after we've done all of these discussions with everybody, we are going to look at putting forward some sort of final report recommendations around what it could look like in Tasmania. And then we'll be going forward and doing our advocacy in that space moving forward.
Yes, Steve says on the text line here that Tasmania is behind the times. Other states have mobile abattoirs. Well, I do know it took a long time in Victoria to get that ability to kill on farm.
Yeah, look, I think there's appetite there. I think that, it makes logical sense in terms of all of the reports that we're seeing from the CSIRO, Reshaping Australian Food Systems, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. They all talk about localising our food system and shortening our supply chains, which inherently brings about amazing, community, human and environmental health benefits. So part of doing this work is about looking at how we can do that in Tasmania. And I think that there's appetite to try and look at those outside, well, not even outside the box, but those alternative models, and enabling our farmers to have control of their product.
I have heard that things like meat inspector training, and even, as you said, training for butchers, etc., is there's been a few hiccups along the line with some of that.
Yeah, look, I think it's like anything. You know, if TASTAFE doesn't have enough takers to a course, they may consider not being accredited for a course in the future, which may then mean we'd have to bring someone into Tasmania to do that kind of training. We really don't want to see that. Sprout is absolutely just, you know, we are driven to make this kind of thing work here in Tassie, to do what we can to try and encourage people to think about how Tassie could be best practice, how Tassie could show the rest of Australia how this kind of thing could work with training, animal welfare and processing for local farmers to ensure that they have this piece of the puzzle works, so that we want them to be price makers, not price takers. And at the moment, we obviously know through all the conversations you've had earlier on the program, we've got the inquiry about supermarket pricing, and essentially we understand at the moment that consumers are hurting and farmers are hurting. The system is inherently broken, and we would really like to see the work done to enable, to put these enablers in there within the infrastructure that's required to give our farmers the right to be price makers and to thrive.
Well, Jen Robinson, a lot of work ahead of you. Just finally, the farmers in the Huon Valley that have really don't feel they've got anywhere they can send their livestock to, what do you think's going to happen there?
Oh, look,
stalemate.
I wouldn't know. Look, what I hope, what I'm optimistic about is that we are able to bring everybody together. And by everybody, I mean the shareholders of the business, the local council, Department of State Growth, Natural Resources and Environment, bring everybody together and look at what we can do differently in that space. I'm optimistic that something will come from that. Through challenge always comes, you know, amazing opportunity. So, you know, I just hold out hope that we can actually find a solution for those farmers, because they don't have an alternative, a lot of them.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you'll come across in your pursuits in the next little while is, you know, trying to get people to work in these places as well. It's not that easy to get good skilled people. So,
yeah, it is a challenge, and I think that for many, you know, it is a confronting environment to be in. But I think we all, you know, enjoy eating meat. Animals are actually also part of our climate solution. They're biological tools on farms to enable regeneration of landscapes. And I think that the more we have transparent, open discussions about this kind of part of our food system, the better.
Yeah. We've just had another text. This one from Judy. As a consumer, I want to see local farmers stay on farms. Why are supermarkets allowed to send animals offshore for processing only to ship the meat back for sale? If the investment was in local infrastructure, surely it's better for everyone, Judy. You never know, Judy. Jen Robinson here, who is about to do a review and study abattoirs sort of around the state, may come up with some ideas, and we'll see whether, you know, what gets sent to government.
Yes, look, we would love anybody to get in touch if they're involved in any of this in any way or have any thoughts about things. Please get in touch with us at Sprout. We'll also be hanging out at AgFest at site 146B if you want to come and find us.
We'll be there too.
So, yep, I know you'll be there. Fiona, we'll drag you in to have a chat. Yep. We're in there in a local food system tent in collaboration with 7 other organisations in this space to show what can be done with great collaboration in terms of our food system. So I'm excited about AgFest and the project. So please get in touch if you are too.
Yeah, so Sprout will be at 146B. And just finally, what does Sprout stand for again?
Oh, look, it's not actually an acronym officially. You know, we could say it's the sprouting of an idea.
Sprouting of a business.
Yes.
Beginnings.
Yes.
All right, Jen Robinson, thanks so much for joining me on the Country Hour.
Thanks for having me, Fiona.
Keeping you updated every day, the Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen.
The warm, dry autumn has been ideal for commercial orchardists in the thick of apple harvest. At Sidmouth in the Tamar Valley, the Chinese-owned AAAW orchard is busy picking with the help of a Pacific Islander workforce. Larissa Smith called in to catch up with operations manager Brendan Bell.
It'd been We're standing in a jazz block at the moment, one of the younger jazz blocks that we've got, and we're doing a second colour pick, our final colour pick in the block, so we try to get them in two picks, and it's going quite well at the moment, actually, yeah.
Okay, so what's the ideal piece of fruit that the consumer or ultimately the supermarket wants?
They want something like this colour here.
It's a deep red with just tinges of green.
Yep, just all colour, like it's possibly 90% red with a small patch of green, so, and that's the ideal piece of fruit, yeah.
And what's so special about jazz? Why have you decided to invest more in this variety?
It's what the company got into a number of years ago. We find it's a good colour crop for us to pick here. It has nice firm fruit, blemish free, and it grows really easily, so we find that's quite good. It was a variety that, like, we grow well here, so we go with something that we know, so it's just the way it is. We do have, like I say, 17 hectares of that, 16 hectares of jazz, but we also have 17 hectares of gala as well, which is a high colour gala that we pick here as well, so we tend to stick to what we know at the moment. And there are a lot of club varieties around, but we just haven't decided yet which other way we would like to go.
So much choice.
There is. There's a lot of choice. There's a lot of different companies with a lot of different varieties at the moment, and it's very hard to make a choice on which one you would like to grow. There's a lot of different things involved in how the marketing is, how much return you can get on your investment, whether it's a good variety for you to grow. So that's all got to come into it. And we've grown this one for a number of years here, and we've done fairly well with it, so we just keep going with that one at the moment.
It's been very dry, as you know. Has that affected the way these trees have produced fruit this season?
It has been reasonably dry. I think a lot of that contributed to maybe a slightly lighter gala crop this year, but other varieties, it seems to have not hindered them too much. It has been requiring a lot of extra watering. We actually are watering a lot more than what we normally would, but it seems to be working okay at the moment. It's nice and moist under the trees, so it's going well.
The weather's been beautiful, beautiful autumn weather for picking, so
it is.
So no days off.
No days off. It's really good. The guys have actually done really well. We're in front with all the picking. We're not behind, so it means that we can get to the fruit when it's in good quality. It's at the right maturity to harvest it. Like, these guys have done really well. I mean, they're averaging roughly 200 bins a day at the moment, and that means that we can actually get the fruit off quickly, get it into the cool rooms. It makes these guys happy as well.
So you've loaned these seasonal workers from Hillwood Berries?
They've been with us for a while, and it's been really good to have that return worker. Like, it's less training and everything else, as everybody realises. If you've got the return worker, it's easier to get the work done. So that's been good.
The Samoans and Tongans, big, strong fellas.
They are strong fellas, yes. And sometimes we have to rein them back a bit because they go too hard. But no, it's been a good problem to have.
How many hectares do you have all up here?
On this site here, we have 44 hectares of apples, around about 16 hectares of cherries. And at our Hillwood site, we've got another 12 to 14 hectares of apples and another 16 hectares of cherries.
This business is Chinese owned. So what's the process from here in terms of where these apples end up?
It depends on the variety. China like a nice bright red apple. That's what we target with the galas. It's a very high colour red, and that's what China like. With a lot of the other club varieties, they are actually managed by the people that own the rights to the variety, so we don't have any say in where that goes.
These will end up at a premium retail space in China.
The galas will, yes, and they end up in a reasonably good environment, yeah, to sell the fruit, and it's a premium sort of price, yeah.
Do you have any plans to increase production of your varieties here, or are you just content with chipping away at what you've got?
At the moment, we're just chipping away. We don't see us going any more on the apple side, maybe more on the cherry side. Again, that's just a company preference. It might be where we look at the future in the future.
Do you have a favourite variety?
Of apple? Yes, I do. I quite like an Envy. It's juicy, sweet, crunchy, and I just like the taste of them. Yeah.
And that was Brendan Bell. He's the operations manager for AAAW at Sidmouth in the state's north. Time now for the Livestock Report with Richard Bailey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Fiona. How are you? That was an interesting story.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I love and envy myself, I have to say. but what's happening in the markets?
Okay, yesterday at Perenna, 153 trade and grown cattle, but it's pretty similar to last week. Quality wasn't as good in the young cattle section, and prices lost the gains of last week, mainly on quality, and just a little bit of less competition, although restockers were pretty strong on most of the yearlings. Yearling steers made, the best of the yearling steers made, 214 to 248 cents. Leaner, 170 to 190. Best heifers, 180 to 208 cents. Few grown steers and bullocks. Most made 208 to 240 cents. One very heavy bullock, too heavy for one of the works to handle, made 150 cents. There were 70 cows. The cow averages were cheaper. Just a few more cows around through the markets through eastern Australia this week or the last couple of weeks, which is probably causing that. Best heavy cows made 160 to 184 cents. Leaner, 120 to 152. And very lean, 58 to 90 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls anywhere from 120 to 150 cents a kilo. Tomorrow at Perenna, Nutrien's third sale, weaner sale, and at the last count, there'll be over 4,000 weaners there, so big sale, good opportunity. It's one of the last of the main weaner sales, so good opportunity to buy there. Back to a noon start, 12 o'clock start.
Okay, and sheep and lamb.
Okay, over in the lamb market, just a few more lambs, 1,567 lambs. Just a little bit more weight than what we've had in the last few weeks, and a lot of store lambs. The processing lambs were just a tad cheaper in places till you got to the MK lambs, lighter lambs, and they were quite a bit cheaper. Most of the store lambs were actually dearer. There were a couple of store buyers in the market and made these lambs, you know, anywhere from $10 to $20 dearer in places. They had to be shorn and had to be well-bred. Best heavy lambs, $134 to $162. Trade lambs, $115 to $140. Light trade, $94 to $120. And light lambs, $40 to $60. Restockers bought the best of their lambs for $85 to $112. And lighter lambs, $60 to $80. Over in the mutton yard, 782 mutton, which is just a few more than last week. Heavy sheep were cheaper, and medium and light sheep were dearer, and $5 to $10 dearer. Though some of the lighter sheep, I thought, probably sold as well as I've seen for some time. Heavy and extra heavy sheep made $48 to $61, and then medium weights, $48 to $56, and light, $30 to $42 a head.
All right, Richard Bailey, thanks very much.
Talk to you on Friday.
Time now to catch up with Joel Reinberger. Joel, hello.
Hello there, Fiona. Now, if there's anything we've learned in the last few years, it's how important a team name is.
Yes.
Like, I think the Jack Jumpers nailed it. Like, all of Tassie got behind that team, I think, because they chose that name so well. The Tassie Devils football team, it was kind of inevitable.
Yes.
You know, it's what they kind of had to do.
And yet,
you know, you think they could have, you know... The Turbo Chooks. Why aren't they the Tassie Turbo Chooks?
I like that, yeah.
But anyway, so we're going to meet someone. The Tasmanian team competing in an air race across the deserts around Australia. So flying thousands of kilometres. It's kind of like orienteering on a national scale.
Wow.
in an aircraft. And it turns out that this pair are, in fact, the champions. They won this last year, and they're called... The Tassie Hangar Rats.
Tassie Hangar Rats. I'm not sure about that one.
What a great name. So we're going to catch up with Greta Kingston, who's the pilot of the pair, and find out about her plane and how she goes about winning this competition. And she's at a conference for female pilots in WA as we speak.
Fantastic.
I'm kind of interested to find out, you know, what are a
What's
bunch of female pilots like when they get together, and what sort of things they're talking about together. Also today, we're going to meet Graeme Simsion. Everyone knows him as the author of The Rosie Project.
Oh, yes.
Massively popular book and then book series. He's got a new book out called The Glass House, which he's written with his wife, who is a professor of psychiatry. And it's about a psychiatry trainee in a psychiatric ward, like a severe psychiatric ward.
They are patient?
No. She's a trainee. She's a doctor learning her way.
Right.
So very keen. And he's touring 400 bookshops in 4 months.
Wow, that's a lot. Thank you, Joel Reinberger, and I'll catch you again tomorrow at 12.
What's the radio station I listen to the most?
ABC Radio Hobart.
ABC Radio Hobart.
ABC Radio Hobart.
Now we're talking.